Welcome to another episode of Rider Support.
This week, we're going to be talking about, should you be doing fasted rides, how you can improve your hill climb? Are we being ripped off by the industry again by cycling helmets? Is a cheap one just as safe as an expensive one? But before all that, controversial topic, close passes.
Hi, Anthony and Sarah. I sent a driver to jail. Yeah, I got hit by a motorist about 4 years ago and finally he's been put behind bars. I won't go into too many of the details except to say I'm based in the UK and thank God I had a small camera mounted to my bike so I got the footage. I know that Anthony has spoken in the past about not creating a motorist versus cyclist mentality, but I'm wondering if his mind has changed recently given the sheer amount of close passes that have occurred on roads in the last year. I know you guys have chatted about this a few times, but I feel the topic needs as much airtime as possible. Does Anthony encourage cameras and report near misses and close passes?
Yeah, I really struggle with this subject a lot. I struggled with the podcast. We had Sean Landers on, one of my friends who lost his girlfriend out training. And I know Wes, our producer over the far side of the room there, he was struggling to even edit that episode.
His girlfriend was killed by a motorist.
Yeah.
Like that's the thing that we have to be careful about how we even word this. Gabby was killed by a car. Not that she lost her life. Not that she died. She was killed by a car.
Yeah. And since then, tensions are higher in Dublin, definitely. Cyclists, especially in the cycling community, they're more reactive to close passes. They are more aggressive, I think, in response to close passes. And it's been an escalation that it's inevitable and I don't really know the solution to it. Are cameras the solution? I would have said 6 months ago, no. Now, maybe I think they can form part of the solution. I don't think they're the solution, but possibly part of it. I know a couple of guys in our club, they had a close pass last year and this before Gabby passed away. They reported it to police. One of them was reluctant at the time because it was a lot of hassle reporting and giving statements, but they just got letters back last week to say that the driver had been cautioned and he had been fined. So the guards did follow it all the way through, offered them victim support and everything, like a proper case. And that's the first time I've seen it properly follow through.
I think we're a bit skeptical, aren't we? We think, oh, if I go into the police station, guard station, as we call it here in Ireland, nothing's going to be done. You know, it's like they're all under pressure. They're understaffed. The last thing they probably care about is somebody close passing a cyclist. And I don't think that that's the case anymore. I think that the policing systems, the judicial systems all around the world are kind of putting this as a priority. And quite recently in the UK, they upped the sentencing time for drivers if you hit and hurt or kill a cyclist, which is a really, really positive thing. But then does it kind of increase this chasm between motorists and cyclists even further?
Look, it's not hard. If that is a priority, close passes, and that's a priority to prosecute it, it's not hard because cyclists could be just going out equipped with cameras. There's an initiative that I seen in Northern Ireland, which me and Sean Landers talked about on the podcast, where cyclists were going out, but the cyclist was actually a guard and he had a camera built into his bike and he phoned ahead to a motorbike. So as soon as he got a close pass, he just phoned ahead to the motorbike, said, close pass, here's the reg. The motorbike would go up, stop the car, show them the footage of the close pass on the iPad, and they'd have a chance to respond and they get an on-the-spot fine or else they get a date in court, depending on how they responded to it. That's maybe a way to do it, but I don't have the answers as to your answer to this.
I think I would very strongly consider putting a camera on my bike in the last couple of months. I mean, I was out the other day. I've never gotten as much of a fright as I did by a close pass with like one of those garbage collection trucks. I honestly thought I was a goner. And I just thought like, if I had that footage, you know, even to take the reg and complain to the company, I don't know how far I would even take it. If I had the footage, I might have come home and been totally calm about it and just been like, oh, chalk it down. But I'm honestly really considering putting a camera on at this stage because it's gone absolutely berserk out there. We are seeing a lot of prosecutions in Ireland for this. Now, I'm not sure how it is across the rest of the world, UK, Canada, mainland Europe. I mean, I firmly believe that the drivers in Europe, mainland Europe, do have a lot more respect for cyclists. Now, again, maybe I'm biased. I'm cycling in locations where it's very kind of cycling friendly areas, Mallorca, Girona, places like that. But in Ireland, we have just had somebody basically put into prison for 7 years and banned for driving for the 10 years when they get out of prison. That person was drunk, on drugs, and basically severely hurt a cyclist. Another person quite recently has been sentenced for a good few years in prison. They unfortunately, for them, went out, knocked down a cyclist, really, really hurt them. And that was an off-duty police officer. So that was certainly going, you know, feeling the full force and going the entire way through the judicial system. But yeah, I don't know. Can't see you ever having putting a camera on your helmet, Anthony, but no, I am strongly considering it.
No, I don't think so. But look, let us know in the comments if you're using a camera on your bike or not, and if you found it helpful. Personally, I don't see the value in posting these close pass videos on social media. I think that widens the us versus them gap. If you're using the camera and reporting them, I think that's a different thing.
There's a guy in the UK at the moment, I think it's London, he's quite famous, and he just goes around videoing people who are stopped in traffic jams or queues on their phone, and he reports everyone. He's had over, I think, 1,000 reports of people on their phones.
I've seen videos this guy, he's just aggravating. That's like someone that's exasperating us versus them problem. Like,
yeah,
I think most people are reasonable. I want to move on from this because we're getting kind of bogged down on it, but I had a close pass the other day and a driver beeped me at the traffic lights and came up and he's like, I'm so sorry about that. I don't think everyone that close passes you acknowledges or they set out to cause you harm, but regardless of motive, it's still a problem at the moment.
MyWoosh is hands down the best virtual cycling app for home, and it's redefining indoor training at no cost. Yep, it's absolutely free. And setting up MyWoosh is really easy. Just download the MyWoosh app, connect your device like your watt bike or your smart trainer, and off you go. Now, if you're feeling competitive, there's weekly races for every category from beginner to pro. Plus, there's insane prize money up for grabs. Now, if you've no plan to race, that's no problem. There's hundreds of free training plans and workouts that are designed to really push you to your limits. You can enjoy daily group rides and group workouts, and you can customize your avatar all without opening your wallet. So go on over to the MyWoosh app and have a look around. Why spend money on monthly subscriptions elsewhere when MyWoosh offers all of this for free? So join MyWoosh today. It's available on iOS, macOS, Google Play, Apple TV, or click on the link in the show notes to get started. Okay, let's move on to the next question. Anthony, have you got any training tips for improving hill climbing? It's my weak point, and although I feel like I'm really struggling, my heart rate rarely goes above 155 beats per minute, which suggests I could go harder. And that's from another Anthony.
Oh, congratulations on your name, sir.
Good, strong name.
I would encourage you to go back and listen to our episode with Dr. Stephen Seller. So Stephen Seller has this idea of we should be doing 80% of our training in easy zone. So we can get really bogged down on zone two. And we had a reaction video to Peter Attia talking about zone two. And that's kind of based off Andrew Coggins' six zone system. And then you start looking in each zone and you're looking for an adaptation you get in each one of these zones. It starts getting quite complicated. Stephen Seller advocates a much easier to understand three zone system, like a traffic lights. Really easy, middle of the road, really hard. Much easier to understand. But 80% of your training, he believes, should be in the super easy zone. And if you're looking to improve your climbing, you have three levers that you can pull across the week. So you look at how much available time you want to allocate to cycling. So say you only have 6 hours you want to allocate to cycling across the week. Now you get to decide what order you pull these three levers in. The first lever you have to pull is frequency. That's how many times you can train across the week. The second lever you can pull is duration. That's how long any of these sessions are going to be. Can you go from a 60-minute to a 120-minute session? The last lever to pull is intensity. But he's at pains to say you should do at least 12 weeks where you just focus on frequency, where you don't worry about how long you ride, don't worry about how hard you ride, just worry about establishing the habit. So getting out the door as many times as you can for a 12-week period before you go on to pull the second lever, which is duration. And it's only after you've established a frequency and started building out up to your max duration that you start playing around with intensity. So many of us were in this kind of instant gratification that we want everything right now, but it's a house. You need to build the foundation first. You can't go worrying about what the penthouse design looks like unless you've dug the foundation. So many of us are missing that. And I think that's a good place to think about your climbing, because you can lay a foundation now, which will mean you're going to be climbing better for next year, the year after, the year after, the year after, rather than focusing on some short-term gains and saying, okay, here's a session that's really going to improve your climbing and just going straight into doing high-end stuff now.
Okay, next question, and this is from Kev. What is the need for all this new cycling tech that only the local bike shop can fix? Is this really the direction that we all want to go in?
I don't know. I have disc brake bikes now and I love them. I can't work on them. I don't know how to bleed brakes. I borderline know how to change the pads on the disc. I don't know how to service my SRAM ETAP. It needs to go into a computer. Don't think I have the wire. So yeah, if I need work done on the bike, I need to drop it to the local bike shop, or I'm lucky enough that I have a friend who's a mechanic and he works on the bikes. Sarah's Cervelo, which is a hand-me-down from me, that's all old school. Like, I can take that bike apart and put it back together in 45
minutes.
Like a
gun.
It's a pleasure to work on. The parts are... they're not hard to get. They're getting harder to get, to the point that I don't think you're going to be able to get them in 2-3 years' time. So regardless of if we want that direction, that's the direction we're being forced at the moment by the bike industry. There's some cool options. Like, you could go and get a custom Mariposa bike, which I will do at some point. Like, this steel handmade bike from like Michael Barry over in Toronto. You could pimp it out with an old school Dura-Ace rim brakes, all mechanical, and that will do you for a long, long time. You could stockpile some of these parts and be super self-reliant for the next decade. It's like a doomsdayer for cycling.
I actually think, okay, Kev, right? Welcome to modern society where technology evolves and gets better, and unfortunately becomes...
not always gets better.
But it becomes a little bit more complicated. Anthony, if you want to, and I'm not saying for a moment that I know how to bleed brakes or change disc pads or work on my bikes, but if I really wanted to, if I was very motivated, there's loads of resources to do so, to learn, to go on a course, to go on YouTube,
yeah, that's fair,
to play around with that. So I think this kind of like, oh, the bikes are too complicated and I have to put it into the mechanic. I don't know. Like, I can only speak for the mechanics I know. None of them have PhDs. They've just done courses and they figured it all out and they just spent a little bit of time working on it. You don't have the wire to plug in your SRAM to see if it needs an update. That's like a simple, simple thing to do. So I think that this whole... I mean, can you imagine? Anthony's dad is hilarious. He thinks that the Clifton pedals are... he just thinks that these are the most dangerous things in the world ever.
He thinks
the toe straps should come back. And that's kind of what this question makes me think of. Like, we are getting these... yes, I think some of them are created by the bike industry, so we spend money. But... I just don't think there's any point in bitching and moaning about it. Just if you want to work on your bike, put in the time and effort to learn how to do so yourself.
My dad's a good example there, because he has this exact same approach with cars, where he used to be able to work on every aspect of his car. And now he says, you open up and it's like working on a computer. You need to be a computer engineer to work on your car. So the bike industry has gone the exact same way. We need to learn this new stuff if we want to continue working on our bike, which is a very good point, Sarah, because I didn't know how to work on my bike at the very start and I had to learn. So maybe I need to rescale.
Yeah, so you're getting old now and set in your ways.
Yeah, but it's the same in every generation and it's the same debate for everything. It's like the older riders now, they're approaching late 30s that are still professionals. They're like, bunch is getting more dangerous these days.
They forget when they were the ones doing like absolutely kamikaze stuff and the older riders were looking at them going, oh, Dude, relax.
Kev, you're old, buddy. You're old. We're all getting old.
Okay, next question. And this is from Ian. Do you have any tips on fasted rides to trim the fat and improve fat metabolism? Do you have a protocol to get the most out of it? Apparently, Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas used to compete over who was going to eat less on long rides. And the source for that information is apparently Geraint's podcast. So straight out of the horse's mouth.
Hey, Roadman, excuse the short interruption. I love riding the bike, but on account of being so busy with the podcast at the moment, I'm now what's called a time-crunched rider. I never thought I'd see the day. But I have a tool. I'm using Wattbike to keep myself sharp and on point with specific sessions to maximize that available training time. I have a Wattbike Atom right here in the recording studio beside me. And when I have an hour in between interviews, I jump on. It's removing all the friction points for me. There's no more 10-minute setup, unfolding legs, banging my knees off stuff, getting my hands dirty, the usual connection issues. It just works every single time. The Atom's perfect for virtual racing as well because it has crisp gear changes, it has 1% accuracy, and it has max gradient capability of up to 25%. If you're looking for an indoor trainer, I honestly couldn't recommend this any higher. I've been using a Wattbike since 2013. Honestly, it's the last indoor trainer that you're ever going to need. If you head on over to wattbike.com now and use code ROADMAN10, that's ROADMENTEN, and that's going to get you 10% off your Wattbike. I think this has changed. I don't disagree that Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas used to compete over who could eat less. And we had like the slogan in cycling, eating is cheating, for a long time. And Van de Velde was on the podcast talking about when they were in Girona, the US postal guys back in the day, they would fall in the door. They would do 6 hours and they'd have like an apple or something. And they'd come in the door just absolutely dead. This has totally changed. There's no research to show now that you're going to oxidize fat any better in the absence of carbohydrates. So that's the underlying rationale here, that you're going to oxidize fat better if you deplete your glycogen stores. That's proven to be factually incorrect. So I have a good few podcasts coming up with dietitians and people specializing in sports science to talk in depth about that. But the biggest thing I've learned in the last couple of years around this is there's a time to cut back your calorie expenditure. Growth only happens in the presence of surplus. It never happens in the presence of deficit. That was like Olaf Bude, a mad wizard scientist coach on the podcast talking about this.
Hey, he's had a little bit of success here and there.
Yeah, and the guys aren't super lean.
No, they're not.
They're the best in the world and yeah, they're not super lean. And that's because
of this. Two top triathletes in the world.
That's because of this, because you can't grow in a deficit. You can only grow in a surplus. So you should actually be looking to up your carbohydrate intake on the bike to 80 or 100 grams per hour, really pushing the limit of what your gastro tract will take, because this suggests that more carbs on the bike it's going to improve your performance on the bike. It's going to improve your recovery off the bike, but it's also going to improve your satiety levels across the rest of the day. So net, you're actually going to eat fewer calories across the entire day than if you fasted for the ride. You're going to have compromised performance during the ride, compromised recovery, and then eat more calories across the rest of the day. Rob, man, I know how serious you take your goal setting, whether they're fitness or life-related goals. If you're looking for a powerful ally to support you on this journey, look no further than Huel. Huel has become my secret weapon for when I don't have time to prepare a balanced meal. It ensures I get the nutrition I need without sacrificing time or taste. Plus, it stops me from reaching for that takeaway menu. I always throw a bottle into my backpack when I'm heading into the city to work, and it stops me eating junk convenience foods, snacking on croissants and bars of chocolate, because I know they don't support my training goals. It's a handy, nutritious meal on the go, and it's got over 22 grams of protein. Huel is perfect for athletes that don't have time to cook or prepare food before a training session. It's convenient, nutritious fuel at your fingertips, ensuring you hit your daily fueling needs for that session. Huel Ready to Drink has 26 essential vitamins and minerals in every single bottle. You're getting a whopping 175 health benefits. Plus, it's made from natural ingredients like tapioca, sunflower seed, coconut, and more. The best part? It's the flavors. There's 8 crazy beautiful flavors. Iced coffee is what's in my backpack right at the moment. You can get Huel directly to your home. All you got to do is head on over to the Huel website, huel.com/roadman.
Yeah, I think there's been an absolute sea change in this whole outlook with regards to fasted rides. We've talked about fasted rides so many times on the podcast, you know, do it in the morning, do a very easy ride, etc. But it's really a hard no from us now.
It's changing, yeah. I would have done fasted rides up to, look, I'd still do them if I'm in a pinch. But that's because, I still do them if I'm in a pinch, but that's because I've slept it out and I haven't got time for breakfast or the shop isn't open to get breakfast or a croissant on the way. That's happened on Saturday. But
yeah, so Ian, we don't recommend fasted rides. We don't have a protocol for you, I'm afraid. We would say absolutely don't. Yeah, don't do it. Okay, next question, and this is from Jack. Well, Anthony, what's your take on expensive helmets? Is an expensive one around €300 much better than the likes of a Van Ryzel for €100? I had a Met Manta, but it's running close to its retirement date, which I don't know if that's just a trick by the helmet companies to sell more helmets or if it's an actual thing to do with safety. Am I paying more for Met because Pagacha wears one? Okay, so Jack here is a little bit of a skeptic. He is wondering, is it actually, does he need to A, change his helmet first? They do have a lifespan because they degrade, don't they? Because you're sweating into them the whole time. They're taking these like little mini.
Yeah, he's not debating should he change it. He's debating should he buy a new one at the same price point as his previous one or go with a cheaper one, I think is his question.
No, I think he says basically it's close to its retirement date, which I don't know if it's just a trick by helmet companies as well. So he's got kind of two questions. Is this just a marketing ploy that you replace your helmet more often or is it, and should he buy an expensive one?
Yeah, I think it's no harm to replace your helmet. I think it's nice having a nice kit. I get nice motivation from having a nice kit. I would sooner have something cheaper and replace it more often than have something nice. And that's from a motivation standpoint. And I know you're going to, in this kind of fast fashion thing at the moment where you like to have good stuff and hold on to it longer. I just think helmets get smelly and they get scraped up and we wear them so much that it's nice to change them out kind of occasionally. And you don't change it that often, realistically, every 2 years maybe.
So this year I've been not doing any fast fashion shopping. I used to be a online shopaholic and I'd be buying absolute crap constantly. There'd be ASOS deliveries coming here every single day. With regards to helmets though, they get grubby, they get minging. I know personally I get makeup all over the head, the chin strap, things
Jack
like that.
Jack probably doesn't have that problem.
Well, who knows? So I like to change mine, you know, kind of pretty regularly. Plus, I like to have a helmet that goes with whatever I'm wearing that day. I have a couple of helmets, white one, navy one, a brown one, and I like to kind of switch them around. So yeah, that's what I like to do.
I think on the expense of helmets, look, if you can afford it, all these things are as much as you're willing to pay for them is the underlying topic in this, or the underlying consideration. But we talked about this in bikes last week. Why are bikes so expensive? It's the same reason helmets are so expensive. They're rolling in the cost of research and development into the retail price of the helmet. And they're also rolling in their marketing budget into the price of the helmet. Rob Chitellis was on a podcast during the week breaking down why Factor is so expensive. And he said €500 of every Factor bike goes towards the sponsorship of Israel Premier Tech, which is absolutely massive. That's an internal marketing decision for them to sponsor Israel Premier Tech. And then that's passed on to the consumer. The consumer doesn't get to choose whether they sponsor Israel Premier Tech. You're sucking up and you're paying that extra £500 regardless. And it's the exact same thing with the Met helmet. I don't know how much of their budget is folded into paying Pogacar's deal, but a figure that's greater than zero. In terms of safety, there's a European safety standard, EN1078. And that's the basic impact protection that's afforded across... Sorry, I'm going to start that again. In terms of safety, there's a European safety standard across all helmets. That's EN1078. So every helmet you get should provide a basic level of safety, whether that's a €50 helmet or a €350 helmet, you're getting the same level of safety. There is one additional consideration. I think we talked about it a while ago on the podcast, MIPS.
Yeah.
MIPS provides protection against this rotational motion impacts. they only seem to be on the more expensive helmets. And even some of the more expensive helmets have opted out of paying for this MIPS technology because they see it as a bit of a con, I think, isn't
it? Yeah, so MIPS is basically, you can, if you and I set up Roadman helmets tomorrow, we can approach MIPS and ask them if we can use their technology. So you will see MIPS in loads of the helmet manufacturers. So it's pretty common, but it's quite expensive for the helmet manufacturers to get this technology. Kask, for instance, they're another huge company. They decided, nah, screw MIPS, we're going to create our own technology that's going to be as safe. It's kind of a little, they approach it from a little bit of a different angle. The problem is that MIPS and Kask and a lot of the helmet companies do their own testing. So it's kind of like, as you often talk about, putting a bike in a wind tunnel and creating the perfect yaw angle to give you X amount of aero, perfect conditions and, you know, save X amount of watts. Similar enough with the helmets, there's not really that much standards apart from the safety standards that a lot of them will have. We do have a guy on our Roadman group spin, Connor. He is a big fan of Alibaba and he buys his from God knows where, really, really cheap. Those ones will not have met this European safety standard. So I would watch out for that.
That's true though. If they're getting shipped into the EU, you don't think they've met EU safety standards?
No, I would highly, highly doubt it. Yeah, I'd highly doubt it.
I think most of the innovation in helmets in the past 10 years has been around the internal padding system has improved a lot. Also, the sweat management systems have improved a lot. So they're more comfortable, they're more adjustable, and the sweat's not going to roll into your eyes. A lot of the top-end helmets now are focusing on aerodynamics, and that's one of the reasons we're paying more money. But they're in this place where they're balancing ventilation, sweat management, and aerodynamics. Interestingly, I've seen some data on the cheaper helmets because they don't prioritize ventilation, are more aerodynamic than even the top helmets. Wow. Josh Portner on the podcast, who does a lot of the aero testing with EF Education, talked about some of the cheapest helmets he's tested, entry-level ones, are the fastest in the wind tunnel.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So we'll be seeing those in the time trials.
Maybe.
Who knew we could talk for so long about helmets? So what do you think? What's your final advice to Jack about the helmet? Expensive, non-expensive?
Depends on his budget. I think you get a pretty good helmet for €200 and I have a range of helmets and I wear my middle of the road helmet most of the time and it goes with my kit. I like it. The sweat management thing, honestly, I'm in Ireland, it doesn't affect me that much. Go with the helmet. Try on a few different brands and go with the one you like most, but don't feel a peer pressure to buy a helmet that's super expensive. Van Rysel are really redefining the cycling industry at the moment because you're getting the top of the line, the helmet the World Tour riders are wearing at a price that's high street. Is that what we'd call it?
Yeah, I guess so. And we're seeing a lot more of the Van Rysel kit. Spoke about it a few weeks ago. Still yet to see one of the bikes out and about. Still yet to go to the Decathlon. It's a bit far away from us. But yeah, it's kind of watch this space with that. Yeah. So, okay. Hope that answered your question.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's Rider Support. If you have questions for us, please let us know in the comments and we're going to try and get them answered in next week's edition of Rider Support. We've put another video up here, which I think you're really going to enjoy. It's more of myself and Sarah. And please don't forget to subscribe to the channel. That's down here.